Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last week, McDonald's workers across the country walked off the job in protest. The Atlantic magazine reports that on Tuesday afternoon in Chicago, a McDonald's worker and single mom named Adriana Alvarez led a group of protesters who stood with blue duct tape covering their mouths with Me Too scrawled on it in black marker. She said, quote, "I represent thousands of fast food workers who are striking across the country against sexual harassment. Today, fast food workers just like me are breaking the silence. We are taking this historic step, and we're going on strike to tell McDonald's no more sexual harassment." End quote. Earlier this month, 100 janitors marched for 100 miles from San Francisco to Sacramento to urge California Governor Jerry Brown to sign AB 2017. That bill would require sexual harassment and assault training be conducted by survivors. In San Francisco, Olga Miranda, president of Service Employees International Union, Local 87, told the SF Weekly that the Me Too movement was not born on social media. She said it was born out of the courage that women have to be able to say enough is enough. So what is changing as women working low-wage jobs demand better protections and an end to systemic harassment? Today, we are joined by Alejandra Valles, Chief of Staff and Secretary Treasury at SEIU United Service Workers West. Alejandra joins me in studio. Hi, Alejandra. Thank you for coming in.
Good morning. Buenos dias.
And we're joined by Annalise Orlick, Professor of History and Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies at Dartmouth College. Annalise Orlick is author of several books, including We Are All Fast Food Workers Now, The Global Uprising Against Poverty Wages. Hi, Professor Orlick. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you. Well, I want to start by asking you both just how you're reflecting about this moment that we're in right now. So many high-profile men are losing their jobs. We've got the Brett Kavanaugh hearing taking place tomorrow. Dr. Christine Blasey Ford is also scheduled to testify. A second woman has come forward. Now we've got a third woman coming forward. This just broke, and I'm just reading right now from Bloomberg. Let's see here. We've got Christine Blasey Ford, and then another woman is saying that in high school, she knows that Brett Kavanaugh was involved with a number of boys, basically giving girls a lot of alcohol in order to gang rape them. So this just broke about an hour ago. Alejandra, let me start off with you. How are you reflecting on what's going on right now?
Sure. Coming off of a week from September 10th through September 14th of participating with so many amazing, empowered survivors, women janitors that were marching also with fast food workers together to the Capitol and walking to say, we are not victims anymore. We are empowered. What comes up for me in this moment is why I didn't come forward, and what we're seeing on the hashtag of why I didn't come forward and believe survivors. And the stories that I've been hearing from a lot of women who are immigrant women, who are women who are of a socioeconomic status, who live in poverty, women who have documentation issues or do not have status in this country, is that they are scared, and that they're scared of being deported. They were told, you are like the trash that you take out and the toilets that you scrub. There's no place for you here. Nobody's going to believe you. That's how we see immigrants in this country. And so why I didn't come forward when you are a woman of color, when you are an immigrant, when you are poor, looks different. For many of us, I'm a survivor, and why I didn't come forward at the time was because I was shamed and I felt that nobody was going to believe me. But when you start looking at what a lot of these women are living. It's not in a silo. They are immigrant women. They are poor women. They are women of color. And they are also immigrants. And so we have to be able to look at it in its entirety.
And what would you add, Annalise? I just want to give people some detail about what dropped this morning. Michael Avenatti said that Julie Swetnick is his client, accusing Brett Kavanaugh of sexual misconduct, marking the third woman to come forward with claims against the Supreme Court nominee. In a sworn declaration, Swetnick, a Washington, D.C. resident, said she was a victim of one of these gang or train rapes where Mark Judge and Brett Kavanaugh were present at a party in D.C. in approximately 1982. She wrote, quote, "During the incident, I was incapacitated without my consent and unable to fight off the boys raping me." She said she shared what happened with at least two other people shortly after the incident, quote, "I believe I was drugged using Quaaludes or something similar placed in what I was drinking," end quote. So it just keeps coming down, Annalise. How are you reflecting on what's happening right now?
Well, I think I'm reflecting on it both personally and historically. I mean, personally, I'm a survivor, too, of three attempts to assault me when I was a teen, and it is profoundly difficult to come forward, in part because no one believes you, in part because the first time I tried to tell someone about it, I was asked, you know, what I was doing walking in, it was actually Golden Gate Park alone, and what was I doing dressed, how was I dressed? So that's the first message you get. That said, I'm a citizen, you know, I'm middle class, I'm white, I'm now educated, you know, and so, you know, with all of this privilege, which Dr. Blasey Ford has, she's still being attacked and rather mercilessly, as is Deborah Ramirez. And I'm sure it will come down on Julie Swetnick. And I think Alejandra's point is so important. When you are an immigrant, a poor woman, a woman of color, who cannot afford to lose your job, who cannot afford to be to be deported because, you know, what will happen to your children, who cannot afford even to have hours cut because, you know, this job is putting a roof over your kids' heads and food in their mouths, I think that the ramifications of reporting are that much greater. And so I want to really do a shout-out to the courage of these janitors, these fast food workers, the Coalition of Immokalee Workers in Florida, who held a hunger strike in Manhattan back in March in front of Wendy's headquarters to protest what they call rape in the fields, right, the endemic sexual assault of women farm workers. These folks have unbelievable courage, and I think that, you know, is along with the involvement now of famous actresses and women of wealth and influence, that is what makes this moment different from previous moments. That said, we might very well have a Supreme Court justice who will come in with all of these charges because the Senate Judiciary Committee, Republican side at least, seems to have learned absolutely nothing since the Anita Hill hearings of 1991. The contempt, the refusal to listen to women is as deep as it was before, and of course the sluts and nuts defense, which Orrin Hatch tried the last time and which they're clearly trying again.
Well, and I called the Judiciary Committee this morning saying, well, now that a third woman has stepped forward, are you going ahead with these hearings tomorrow? And a press person said, as far as I know, we are. So the hearings are scheduled for tomorrow, and then the vote is scheduled for Friday. I mean, they're fast-tracking this thing, and we're going to air coverage of both of those, live coverage of both of those. That is Annalise Orlick, professor of history and women's gender and sexuality studies at Dartmouth College. She's the author of many books, including We Are All Fast Food Workers Now, The Global Uprising Against Poverty Wages. We're also joined by Alejandra Valles, chief of staff and secretary treasurer at SEIU United Service Workers West. And now I would like to welcome Saru Jayaraman, co-founder and president of Restaurant Opportunity Centers United, an organization that works to raise wages and labor standards for the country's 12 million restaurant workers. Hi, Saru. Welcome back to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So I want to ask you the same question. There's so many new things coming down. How are you kind of making sense of where we are right now?
Well, I really want to echo the last speaker that you know, we now are about to reach actually the 13 million worker mark in our industry. We have we are the second largest private sector employer in the country, and we have the highest rates of sexual harassment of any industry. And it's been an extraordinary year of women in our industry, really not just fast food workers, but we've been focused a lot on tipped workers across the country, women who work in Denny's and IHOPs and Applebee's and casual restaurants across America, struggling with extreme poverty, economic instability, and inordinately high rates of sexual harassment because they have to tolerate inappropriate customer behavior in order to feed their families in tips. In fact, they're encouraged by managers to go out, dress more sexy, show more cleavage in order to make more money in tips. And so we've done so much research showing the connection between the system in which women are forced to live off tips, and in many other states, you know, earning sub-minimum wages of $2 and $3 an hour and forced to live off of tips in order to feed their families. And as a result, the customer has so much power over them and they experience so much harassment as a result. So over the last year, we've seen extraordinary courage from these women, you know, in states across the country, standing up saying, enough is enough. I cannot live on $2 and $3 an hour. I will not feed my family by having to be grabbed and slapped and even raped in order to make that money in tips. And we've been moving policy in New York, D.C., and Michigan. We actually won the elimination of the sub-minimum wage for tipped workers in D.C. in June. We just won the elimination of the sub-minimum wage for tipped workers in the state of Michigan. Michigan just became the eighth state, along with California, to eliminate the sub-minimum wage for tipped workers. And in each of these campaigns, we saw women standing up saying enough is enough, and men screaming at them. In every one of these states, New York, D.C., Michigan, where we've been fighting these campaigns, men, you know, male workers, coworkers, managers, employers, screaming epithets at our women who are standing up in events and hearings and rallies saying, I'm not going to put up with this anymore. Time's up on the sexual harassment. Men screaming epithets at them, you know, F you, you're lying. There's no sexual harassment. We make enough money in tips. You don't need a raise. And despite that, additional trauma, re-traumatization, our women, our members are standing up and saying enough is enough. And so to me, the last year has been seeing women stand up across sectors, seeing us win, wow, you know, real policy change in various states, and seeing women, again, stand up through re-traumatization during the last year that nobody, frankly, is reporting on, the kind of extreme pushback our members are getting from their coworkers and managers and employers, extreme vitriol. I mean, one of our members just received a very nasty death threat last week from a male coworker for standing up and saying, I cannot live on $3 an hour. I am done with the sexual harassment I face by having to live off of tips earning $3 an hour. She received a really nasty death threat. And these are the kinds of things that really have moved us from victims to protagonists. And that's the part that isn't being reported on. You know, I think it's coming to a head with this Supreme Court nomination for sure. Hmm. But there's so much that hasn't been covered in the last year that is both victorious and signs of progress, and then real signs of pushback that happen when you achieve progress and success as women.
And Saru, so you're talking about waitresses across the country who basically have to rely on tips to make ends meet. At this point, what is the average wage for waitresses?
So the federal minimum wage for tipped workers in the United States is still a paltry $2.13 an hour. It is a legacy of slavery. The first tipped workers were black women right after slavery, forced to work for $0 an hour as long as tips brought them to the full minimum wage. We went from zero in 1938 with the first minimum wage to $2.13 today, 80 years later. And it's a population of millions, in fact, of the 13 million workers in our industry, 60% are tipped workers working in full-service restaurants, and they have the highest rates of sexual harassment, again, because they have so much economic instability from tips. There's a power dynamic that exists between them and the customers and the coworkers. They are told by managers, dress more. If you want to make any money at all, because $2 and $3 is not a wage, you have to go out and get it by pleasing the customer and doing what it takes, put out essentially, to make that money in tips. And so that's not the wage in California. But even in California, what we see across the country is that the higher the wage, the less the dependence on tips, the less the incidence of sexual harassment. In fact, the states that have required the industry to pay the full minimum wage rather than a $2 and $3 ridiculous wage actually have one half the rate of sexual harassment as the 43 states with this ridiculous sub-minimum wage for tipped workers. And that's because when you get a full wage from your boss, You actually don't have to rely entirely on tips, and you actually can reject some of the harassment that comes at you because you can count on some income like every other worker in every other industry from your employer. So we know the higher the wage, the less dependence on tips, the less prevalence of sexual harassment. And, you know, you can talk about all kinds of training for workers on what is harassment and litigation to support workers when they come forward and protection for workers when they come forward. All of that's critical and important. But what we'd like to see is structural change that results in preventing the harassment from happening in the first place. And that means raising wages to the place where women don't need to put up with this kind of harassment from customers, coworkers, managers, because they aren't as reliant on the tips to feed their families.
And Annalise, you wrote an article, We Are All Fast Food Workers Now, The Global Uprising Against Poverty Wages. And McDonald's workers went on strike last week. McDonald's CEO, according to the Chicago Tribune, Steve Easterbrook, received total compensation last year of about $15.4 million. What is the average wage of a McDonald's worker?
Well, it varies between 8 and 9.15, and the 9.15 wages, I talked to people who'd already been promoted to manager who were earning, you know, that kind of money. But the point of the title, and it has a lot of bearing on sexual harassment, is that in the age of precarity, everybody has become, you know, a contract worker. No one is a safe, benefited employee. No one has job security. I mean, obviously, a few people do, but it is increasingly rare. That quote was uttered by an adjunct college professor who was making $8.05 an hour and working course to course. And, you know, and I met adjunct professors who had to, you know, sleep in their cars and go on Medicaid and Medicare to support their kids. So all of that makes people more vulnerable to sexual harassment because you have nothing protecting you. You know, your job is never safe. And so people put up with, you know, kinds of behavior that they should not have to, that is frankly illegal. But the problem is that, you know, workers themselves have to enforce these kinds, even when laws are passed. So I wanted to do a shout-out to another amazing campaign by the hotel workers in Chicago, Seattle, Miami, and now in California, and that is Hands Off, Pants On. And it is a campaign to equip every hotel housekeeper with a panic button and to legally require that management, when that panic button is pushed, rescue the hotel housekeeper and eject either the customer or the supervisor who's engaging in this behavior. That is another industry where sexual harassment and unwanted touching and out-and-out rape is absolutely endemic. Two-thirds by some accounts, three-quarters by others. And they won a city ordinance in Chicago, in Seattle, in Miami, and are looking at some state legislation in California. So, you know, there again, I think this is a worker one change in how sexual harassment is regulated, and they have to enforce it themselves. Even once that change is won, as Alejandra, you know, knows better than I, it's the union workers who then are going in there, and the fast food workers who are going in there and having to enforce these regulations. McDonald's has a zero tolerance sexual harassment policy. They just don't enforce it, and they don't answer workers' calls when they say that policy has been violated.
Well, I should mention that we did invite Robert Gibbs to join us, who is the former press secretary for President Obama. He's now global chief communications officer for McDonald's. And Robert Gibbs was in town for the Global Climate Summit a couple weeks ago, and they said, would you like to interview him about our green initiatives? I said, well, I'd like to interview him about sexual harassment, and they never got back. What would you add, Alejandra? There's so much here. We're talking about low wages, cannot make ends meet, and then the everyday harassment that so many people are faced with.
Sure. Well, I think we can't look at all of this in a silo. The workers that we represent, the genders that we represent, the fast food workers that are fighting and organizing out in the streets, they don't live all of this in a silo. Right. So it's not like, oh, I'm going to go to the immigrants' rights rally here. And, you know, and where do women fall within what we're fighting for there? And I'm a low-wage worker, so let me go here with my union. And so we look at our approach to this work. Sexual harassment and assault are deeper power imbalances that have shaped the employer employee relationship for generations. And we have a moment right now where actually Bernice Yearn wrote an article that said, what can the Me Too movement learn from low-wage women that are fighting this? And so we've been working with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers because their model has really been about how do you empower the workers so that they have a voice, so that they can change those power imbalances and they can change and have power over their wages and modern-day slavery and human trafficking and sexual assault and rape on the night shift. And so that's been the model that the janitors in California have taken and are really doing just amazing work and not at just checking off the box of liability and compliance. Nobody walks around with their policy, whether it's here or at McDonald's and just, oh, I have it in my back pocket. So what, you know, what we do need to do is figure out how we have worker-centered solutions where janitors, fast food workers, where restaurant workers, where hotel workers have the power in the moment to stop the harassment, to intervene, where men can feel empowered to say, stop, that's unsolicited and unwanted, and also intervene and be active bystanders. And so what we've been doing in California is empowering the janitors to be able to go into every building, do self-defense classes, mm-hmm. teach women how to protect themselves and how to respond so that if they're attacked at 3 o'clock in the morning, assaulted or raped, they can at least fight back. And when they don't have the agency and their agency to say no is not respected, then to know where they can go to get help. And to hear from other women and other survivors who have gone through this, who are certified, who are the experts. But I think there's a moment right now where everybody's looking to the consultants and looking to the lawyers and looking to the, you know, outside people to come in and save the workers. The workers can save themselves. Workers can be empowered, mm-hmm. can have a voice at work through their union or their organization, but they can also be the experts that start changing this from the bottom up and change the culture where it's happening.
And to that point, Annalise, I know you have to leave us in just a couple minutes, but what would you add? I mean, in a recent piece, you wrote that the low-wage workers came out and spoke out long before Me Too became front-page news, and they are continuing to speak out.
Well, one thing that I want to say is this is also global. So you've got a global day of action against gender-based violence in the workplace. It was last November 25th. Women garment workers, in particular, walked out around the world in the Philippines, in Bangladesh, in Cambodia, and they are fighting for an International Labor Organization convention which would have a global policy of zero tolerance for sexual violence in the workplace. And the great thing about that is that, you know, countries ratify ILO conventions. So if once a country ratifies it, it's federal law, and that helps organizers to enforce it. So I just want to reiterate what it's really an honor to be here with Alejandra and Saru, you know, who are, you know, great activists and in the field doing this. And I want to say that I absolutely agree that worker-led solutions, all of the evidence, all of the studies show that worker-led responsibility codes, worker-led safety inspections, worker-led mediations of sexual harassment cases are the only thing that really changes conditions for low-wage workers. And so that is the wave of the future, and I'm excited to see it building.
And just quickly, Annalise, I'm so glad you brought up international workers, because when Nike struck a deal with Colin Kaepernick, some people did bring up the fact that most of the women and men making Nike shoes, Nike clothing, you name it, are making like $1, $2 an hour. And we're now learning that Nike has made $6 billion since that Colin Kaepernick ad. I was hoping that that angle would get more attention. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I have posted a little bit, a few things about that, because indeed, the Cambodian garment workers did a fashion show a couple of years ago where they noted what their wages were versus Nike's wages. You had a Thai worker whose factory was closed when the workers tried to organize touring the United States, and saying that, you know, Nike's campaign to rebrand itself as a brand that empowers women and, you know, that is socially conscious is a brilliant branding effort, but that's all it is.
Right.
You know, in terms of its own workers, I think the last estimate, Nike is the biggest employer of women in Vietnam, and those women are making an estimated quarter of what they need to survive in Vietnamese cities where Nike factories are located. So I would say, what's the slogan of the Colin Kaepernick Act? You know, dare to believe in something, even if it means sacrificing everything. So I would love to call Nike on that bluff.
Yeah. Well, here, here. Annalise Orlik is professor of history and women's gender and sexuality studies at Dartmouth. She's the author of many books, including We Are All Fast Food Workers Now, The Global Uprising Against Poverty Wages. Professor Orlik, thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for your work.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, and thank you all for your work. It's been a real pleasure and an honor.
Thank you. Coming up after the break, we'll continue talking about sexual harassment and the demands of low-wage women workers with Alejandra Valles, Chief of Staff and Secretary Treasurer at SEIU, United Service Workers West, and Saru Jayaraman, co-founder and president of Restaurant Opportunities Centers United. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are talking about how low-wage women workers are organizing for better protections from sexual harassment and an end to systemic assault. Today we're joined by Alejandra Valles, Chief of Staff and Secretary Treasurer at SEIU, United Service Workers West, and Saru Jayaraman, co-founder and president of Restaurant Opportunity Centers United. They work to raise wages and labor standards for almost 13 million restaurant workers in the U.S. If you have a question or comment for our guests about this issue, we've done a lot of shows about low-wage women workers, which farm workers, Walmart workers, janitors, they've been talking about these issues long before Me Too exploded. But it is great to see a number of different groups now coming together to work on these issues. So what questions do you have? If you work in a low-wage job, if you have any experiences you'd like to share, if there have been changes at your workplace, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. 8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We have an email from Greg who says, one of your guests, that was Saru, mentioned that low-wage male workers were shouting down low-wage women workers at a rally about sexual harassment. Is it the case that low-wage men generally regard equality for women as a threat to their prospects? Is it inevitable that low-wage men and women workers be competitors in a zero-sum game? Saru, what would you say?
Oh, it's absolutely not inevitable. I think to provide more context to that particular situation, women have been standing up in the industry alongside men in these places, New York, D.C., Michigan, we're saying enough is enough. We need higher wages. We need to be able to actually get a wage from our boss rather than relying entirely on tips. And having success. As I mentioned, we won this in D.C. We just won this in Michigan. We're on the verge of winning it in New York. And as a result, the National Restaurant Association, which we call the other NRA, it represents the Fortune 500 chains, the IHOPs, the Applebee's, the Olive Gardens, set up a fake AstroTurf worker organization called Restaurant Workers of America to try to spread fear and misinformation among, in particular, male restaurant workers who earn more money in tips in various places, New York City, Washington, D.C., to try to basically terrify them and divide them from workers. So this was from the women. So this was a very intentional, purposeful effort to divide workers. And so in response to the it's a brilliant question, and you're very right. There's absolutely no need for women and men to in any way be divided on this issue. Everybody benefits with higher wages, less sexual harassment, greater equity, including employers benefit. We've done so much research, and I've written several books that show that for employers, they get higher productivity, higher profitability, less turnover. I mean, the industry's growing faster in states that have higher wages, higher rates of tipping. I mean, everything is better for everybody where workers do better. And that's true for men and women alike. But there are very purposeful, intentional efforts to divide workers along lines of race and gender. And in fact, that fake AstroTurf effort to divide workers was done by the National Restaurant Association hiring the Trump-Pence communications firm, the communications firm that worked on the Trump-Pence campaign and did the same thing on the electorate, tried to divide people by race and gender, and now they're trying to do it within the restaurant industry, try to divide workers and terrify men that somehow it's bad for them if women get a raise, it's bad for them if women get equality, it's somehow not okay for women to stand up. And it's a completely fake debate that is intentionally created to keep workers apart. And so the solution really is to know that when there's fear of change, which is really what this all comes down to, when there's fear of change, hope is what takes us through. Hope, understanding that we're all better off in situations where women are better off, in situations where workers are better off, where the wages are higher, we're all better off, all boats are lifted, is what will help us overcome any fear that men, that employers, that white Americans are feeling with regard to greater equity and rising wages for all workers.
And it's important to note, Saru, that when you look at the pay of fast food or these chain restaurants that you just mentioned, the CEO pay, I mean, these men, as far as I know, they're mostly men, they make between like $6,000 and $9,000 an hour.
Exactly. I mean, that we calculated one of the largest leaders of the National Restaurant Association is Darden, which owns Olive Garden and until recently owned Red Lobster, but also Capital Grille Steakhouse. You know, they own 8 or 9 brands, Seasons 52, Bahamas Breeze. They've been fighting vitriolically to keep the wage at $2.13 an hour at the federal level. And their CEO makes 800 times what line workers make as servers, bartenders, dishwashers, cooks in Olive Garden, in these full-service restaurants. And that means that two things. We as customers are not only paying for these workers' wages through our tips. We're subsidizing a multi-billion-dollar company by paying for its workers' wages through our tips. But we are also paying for these workers' survival through $16.5 billion annually in taxpayer-funded public assistance, $7 billion for the fast food sector of the industry, and $9.5 billion for the full-service segment of the restaurant industry. We are paying for these workers' survival through Medicaid and food stamps because no one can afford to live on $2 an hour if you're a tipped worker or $7 an hour if you're not a tipped worker. And so here we are paying for their workers' survival, paying for their workers' wages through the tips. And then you've got these CEOs earning, like you said, 800 times what the workers are making.
Wow. And Alejandra, in the documentary Rape on the Night Shift, which was about janitors and the fact that they're working in isolation many times, I remember that a lot of them are hired by contractors. So what is the average wage for a janitor in, let's say, a wealthy city like San Francisco?
So you have janitors that are represented both by a union contract, and then you have a huge underground economy in California. And in the underground economy, you're talking about human trafficking. You're talking about workers who are living in the shadows, especially within this political environment in this Trump administration, where workers are afraid to say, my wages are being stolen from me. We have huge just modern-day slavery of wage theft that we've seen. So you have some workers who are not even making minimum wage, some workers whose paychecks are being withheld, saying, unless you come to this hotel with me, I'm not going to pay you. Or not getting paid at all and saying, I'm going to call ICE and I'm going to deport you. And this is not just an issue that we're seeing in the U.S. We're also seeing that a lot of these subcontracted companies also, you've seen huge wage theft claims that we have been partnering with our partner organization, the Maintenance Corporation Trust Fund, against Ross, against the Cheesecake Factory. You see just modern day slavery in a lot of these places that we go to. And so part of that is also that you can't ignore what's happening in Mexico and Latin America and El Salvador and Guatemala and all of the forced migration and also the organized crime in a lot of those countries. And so when you put those contractors who anybody who has a mop and a broom can say, okay, I'm going to bid for this work, then at that point in time and with this political environment, you have a situation where there's just massive exploitation and sexual assault. And so in the union, we've been fighting for $15 an hour at a federal level and at a state level, and we've been able to accomplish that. So union janitors across California are making $15 an hour and or more in San Francisco. But what we need to do is address all of the issues that are taking place. It's not just about wages, right, or sexual assault or human trafficking or this modern day slavery. It's about ultimately how do we deal with the power imbalances that exist in the subcontracted out world with building owners or with growers or the Walmarts of the world, the Wendy's of the world, the Taco Bells of the world, right? Mm-hmm. And so there are workers who are figuring that out by putting themselves as at the center of those solutions.
When we did a show about janitors going, I believe they walked to Sacramento even before to pressure Jerry Brown to sign another bill, which he did sign. And then this march from San Francisco to Sacramento is in support of SB 2079, which would strengthen sexual harassment and violence prevention procedures for janitors. Employers would have to prove they'd done sexual harassment training, and it includes a provision for peer training so women can educate each other about the risks of worker night shifts. Sure. So it's not some outside group coming in. These women know what works.
Sure. So in 2016, these women fasted. 18 women fasted at the Capitol to say, we need to do something about this underground economy on the night shift in the janitorial industry. And so they won a registry for janitorial workers, but they also won a very important provision that had not been done in any industry, which was mandate an in-person training. Now, that might not sound like a lot, but in person, when a lot of these companies, all they do is they give you something in writing, say, sign here, you've been trained. In person was key for these women. And so since then, what they started doing is just creating cohorts across California, doing self-defense classes, becoming certified, becoming trauma-informed, so that they themselves could now be the messengers of that in-person training in all of California. Mm. So especially when you put the fear factor in place, who is a woman going to feel more comfortable talking to? Somebody in a suit, an HR person? The traditional HR system has not helped in this industry. It's actually been a detriment, and it's been part of the problem. And so the only way that we're going to change culture, and this is the big part right now that I think we need to move this movement to, is to not just talk about liability and compliance, because we've had laws in the books, mm-hmm. but to really look at what is empowering workers to call each other in, to talk to each other, to put a stop to it when it happens. So to see these women hold hands in front of the Capitol and say no and scream to the top of their lungs. When was the last time that you went out and screamed at the top of your lungs and just said no? And how liberating that is to see restaurant workers and fast food workers out there marching with their, you know, how liberating it is to put some tape in your mouth on an issue that you have not reported or spoken about in maybe decades, and to break that silence. But then to also, I think what the janitors have taught us is they've been fasting. They did a mile walk for 100 women, is that it's through that power of organizing that on this issue, it doesn't just have to be healing through, you know, mental health or through some kind of victim rights advocates. That's a part of it. Mm-hmm. But that organizing, speaking up with other women, marching in your hats out on the streets, that's incredibly empowering, because you're doing that through the collective. And so we have that bill, which is AB 2079, which now would mandate that that in-person training that we won in 2016 be delivered by peer-to-peer, which is janitors who have been certified to be able to do this in the state of California.
What is the status on this bill?
The governor has until September 30th to sign. And we've been told that the governor is going to veto it. That's why you see billboards all across the Bay Area and in San Francisco and Fisherman's Wharf saying, end rape on the night shift. Governor Brown, believe in the power of immigrant women.
Wow.
We do not need the state. We do not need saviors to come in and save these women. Do not coddle these women. These women have the answers. They are the experts. And that would be my advice to a lot of what we're doing now is how do we empower survivors and also some of these men to speak up and to be allies and to be part of the solution. And so I want to just lift up what Saru was saying earlier about the role of men in this moment. We had men walking. We have what we call compadre circles, which have really been looking at how does sexism and play out in our lives, and what is the mask that many of us have been wearing as men, that and how has this impacted the immigrant community? When you look at alcoholism rates within the Latino community, what's the toxic part of our culture? And I think that men having those conversations has been really eye-breaking and really eye-opening for the union and for the janitors, because they are saying this has also happened. Some of them have said this has also happened to me, but I've seen this happen, or I've done this myself, and I'm not a Harvey Weinstein. I want to get better. And that's what we're seeing, is that it's not all the Harvey Weinsteins of the world. There is harassment that happens from coworker to coworker, and so what do you do with that? And there's a part of restoration justice that I think there's so much we can learn about. You can't just, where are these men going to go? They harassed. Now, granted, they assaulted and they raped. We need to be able to deal with that. But having a trauma-informed approach where the perpetrator or the person who is doing the harassing and maybe being part of the whisper culture or laughing understands how that impacted the victim and how that impacted the person who lived it and experienced it, that sometimes that really does have an that changes how they see and how they experience their actions.
Yeah, I just wanted to add to that we actually have been, we've worked with about 700 restaurant companies across the country, big, small, well-known, everybody from Alice Waters and Tom Colicchio and Danny Meyer down to small mom-and-pop restaurants around the country who believe in better wages, greater equity, better sexual or anti-sexual violence policies in the restaurants, higher wages and less dependence on tips. And we've worked with actually hundreds of companies over the last year in this, as Alejandra mentioned, restorative justice concept or model, redemptive model, to say let's move from less equity to greater equity. Let's move from less power for workers to greater power and voice for women and people of color on the job. And we've helped a lot of companies move in this direction, because it's always been our belief that nobody is perfect and nobody is evil, and every employer can do better, no matter how great they are or how far they are from the standards we'd like to see. Everybody can get to that place of actually treating workers well and paying them well. And so we've worked with a lot of companies to do precisely that, including we've worked with some employers who have been accused of sexual harassment, who've worked with us to turn their companies around, and or who are afraid of it, or who have been called out for it, and we've worked with them to turn their companies around. I mean, for us, working with employers to do the right thing and move is the way to go, rather than to simply call people out, which doesn't actually address the structural root of the problem, which, again, we come back to, is the power imbalance that women face on the job.
And speaking of that power imbalance, as you mentioned, it's not just the Les Moonveses of the world, the former CEO of CBS who resigned amidst allegations of sexual assault. Bill Cosby was just sentenced yesterday. But what about the power structures that the women we're talking about today deal with, the store manager, the person who is overseeing the janitors? What about those power structures, Alejandra?
In the janitorial industry, it's 90% of women cleaners and across California, and that are the janitors. But the foremen and the supervisors and the leads are all men. Mm-hmm. And so the power, and I think that that's why those cohorts of going deep with men about the dominant role that they sit in, and to be conscious of that. So it means really creating career paths for women. It means ensuring that they have a real seat at at the table where they can do something about that. But I also think it means really dealing with it as a collective. And that's why we've been so focused on how do we empower those women to and those men in the actual workplace to be able to intervene and change that culture. And so part of the system is that it is more of a traditional HR model. And that's why when we're talking about all of these companies right now revisiting and dusting off their HR policies, their spin books, it's illegal to sexually harass and to assault and to break the law and any of the protected classes. But the problem is not that we haven't had the laws on the books. The problem is that there's no culture of anybody enforcing those policies, of it living, and how do you breathe it? How do you feel it in the actual workplace? And the only people that know what that looks like is actresses in the Screen Actors Guild or within their industry, restaurant workers that are waitresses and that are the people that are doing this work, or janitors who are working on the night shift. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's where a lot of the partnership with allies who have been doing this work all the time, partnering with those organizations to figure out how you empower those workers to do it themselves, is the right approach. Mm-hmm. But what we've been seeing is so much of the, oh, let's just find a consultant to come in here and do it, and let's just have somebody else to come do our sexual harassment training, and let's just add this. And that's not going to help. It's really important to invest in those workers in that industry. And I think that that's what we've been learning from the Immokalee workers. And that's the lessons that I think we can take from the janitors' story and their plight from before the Me Too headlines.
And Saru, what does it look like, the power structure look like in the restaurant industry?
Well, I mean, I think for us, what our research shows over and over again is, again, it's about power. And in our case, the power dynamic is largely related to the fact that you've got so much dependence on tips, which create very variable incomes for workers in this industry, for particularly women, because 70% of tipped workers in America are women. And so what that means is that when you have a mostly female workforce in a restaurant having a very variable income, it could be zero or it could be $200 or $300 that night. And then you have men in manager positions and in the kitchen with stable incomes. In the kitchen, they might be very low incomes, but at least they're stable. They don't go up and down. What that means is that the woman whose income is so fluctuating, it could be zero, it could be $200, it gives every man in the restaurant power over her, the customers, the coworkers, and the managers, so that the customer obviously can tip her little or nothing or a lot depending on how much she's willing to put up, even encourage the harassment, be grabbed, be touched, be talked to in a certain way. And in fact, the research shows, years and years of research shows that women make more money in tips if they allow a man to touch them, a customer to touch them. But it's also true that coworkers have power over her. We had a woman come tell us that she had to sleep with every man in the kitchen in order to get them to make the meals just as the customer ordered them in order to get the tips. So the kitchen staff knows they have power. If they don't make money in tips, they know they have power over her because she's the one with fluctuating income. And of course, the managers have power over her because they're the ones who can give her a different section, a different shift, a different table. And all of that results in her getting very little or a lot in tips. And so when you take away that power and you say, actually, everybody's going to get a livable wage and tips are on top of that, they're an extra as they were always intended to be. The more power you take away from the men in the restaurant being able to control her income that night, the greater power she has to reject harassment or to not be harassed in the first place. And so that's why we keep coming back to, you can do education with the managers, you can do training, you can allow the women to sue, you can do all kinds of things to stop it or to address it when it happens. But wouldn't it be better to address the power structure that's really the root of the problem, so that you can prevent the power dynamic and the sexual harassment from happening in the first place? And that means higher wages, greater power on the job, you know, the ability to collectively organize and stand up and say enough is enough, not having your wages and your tips stolen. Alejandra was talking about wages not being paid or stolen. In our industry, it's tips being stolen is just an enormous problem. You know, employers, you know, doing all kinds of things to take workers' tips away from them. So, you know, protecting workers' tips, giving them power, increasing their wages, giving them voice on the job, and really honoring, supporting, and incentivizing employers that are working with us to do the right thing, move to greater equity, for us are all the ways to address that manager-worker dynamic.
In our final minutes, what can people do to show solidarity with these workers? Alejandra, you mentioned that Governor Jerry Brown might veto AB 2079, which is supposed to strengthen sexual harassment and violence prevention procedures for janitors. Why? What are people saying?
Well, I think it's part of it's, well, the employer should have the right to choose if they want an HR person or their lawyers to do the training. What we're saying is that this should be joint. There should be a part of that training that's a peer-to-peer component of that. And so what everybody in California can do is say, look, let's check ourselves in this moment. Governor Brown, believe in the power of immigrant women to save themselves, to have a voice, and to change the culture in their own industry. We don't, and we can do it collectively, but it, unless you mandate a component of that to be peer-to-peer, employers are not going to do it on their own. Mm-hmm. They have been part of that, of the problem. So right now, what we really need is for the public to say, we believe that janitors are not just good at cleaning our toilets and taking out the trash. We believe in their power and what they've been doing for years now to combat that, and that they can change the culture in their industry. And it's really a condescending attitude of that we see with low wage workers. And so we want AB 2079 passed. We also so you could hashtag, you know, Governor Brown sign AB 2079 or Ya Basta, hashtag Ya Basta, which is enough is enough in English. But more importantly, to start shifting the conversation from liability and compliance to culture change, which includes a real voice for workers on the job.
Sari, what would you add? We have about a minute left.
Great. Well, there are three things people in California can do. One is that actually we've been working on a statewide bill as well, AB 380, that passed both chambers, and is waiting also for the governor's signature, that would make it not voluntary, not mandatory, to sign arbitration agreements that so many large restaurant corporations and other corporations are trying to force workers to sign, that basically don't allow them to sue when they're sexually harassed or otherwise their rights are violated in a court of law. So we really need Governor Brown also to sign AB 380 that would give workers the right to voluntary arbitration, not mandatory arbitration. Secondly, all of you eat out. Everybody eats out. We really want you to encourage your favorite restaurants to join forces with us, to join with the restaurants that are taking the high road to profitability, the one like Alice Waters and Danny Meyer and Tom Colicchio. You can go to onefairwage.org and actually get your favorite restaurant owner right on that app, right on that site, to sign up and join with the right side of history.
Saru Jayaraman is co-founder and president of Restaurant Opportunities Centers United, and Alejandra Valles is chief of staff and secretary treasurer at SEIU, United Service Workers West. Saru and Alejandra, thank you for your amazing work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you. Your Call is produced at KALW in San Francisco. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at Your Call Radio and email show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Laura Wenis produced today's show, and Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.